Ladies and gentlemen, welcome everybody to the Institute for European Studies, where today we're hosting a first of a series of lectures on NATO, but basically security in general. We have with us Dr. Jamie Shea, Director of Policy Planning, still, I hope,
yes.
At NATO's private office, and he will start with the first lecture on proliferation. Now, just as you see the first of the lectures, I would like to remind you that these lectures are taped. They will be broadcasted on the NATO website. But to that end, and also as a courtesy to our speaker, please switch off your mobile phones in case you haven't done that yet. So, Jamie, the floor is all yours.
Anthony, thank you very much indeed. And I'd like, as the first word of this new series of NATO lectures, to, as always, thank you and the Institute of European Studies for once again so graciously offering to host this series. It's always better to be outside NATO headquarters in front of a real group of students. Thank you, of course, to the students here today for being here. I'm always impressed what a free sandwich and a free glass of orange juice can do in terms of attendance. Hopefully you'll still be here for the sixth lecture, even if by then we'll probably have to offer you caviar and champagne. But it's good to see you here today. I must also apologise right from the outset that my strong Cockney accent is even worse than it is normally, because I'm suffering from a very heavy cold. But the show must go on, Nespa, and therefore I will do my best to communicate above my running nose. So it's good to see you here. Now, as Anthony pointed out, this is going to be a series of six lectures in which what I'm going to try to do is to look at the threats that face the alliance today, but the international community more generally, and ask the question, what are the most threatening threats? Are we taking some of them too seriously? Are we taking others not seriously enough? How threatening are these threats in reality? Now, the background for this, as you can see also from this very nice screen behind me, is the new NATO strategic concept. You may or may not be aware, if you're not aware you will be in just a couple of seconds, that over the last few weeks a group of experts under the chairmanship of former US Secretary of State Madeleine Albright has started the work of examining the health of the alliance with a view to making recommendations next May to the NATO Secretary General on what should be the future of the alliance, what should be in and what should be out of the new NATO strategic concept. And whenever you do this exercise of a white paper, as we say in national governments, or a defence review or a strategic review, the starting point obviously is to look at the environment in which you have to operate. And therefore, obviously, for an organisation like NATO, which deals with defence and security, the key question is, well, you know, what are the key challenges that are going to affect the safety of our citizens? Not just what are those challenges, but what are the possible responses where NATO could be more involved? Once you're clear on what your challenges are, it's much easier then to design a new NATO structure or organisation to fit those particular tasks. So what I'd like to do over these next six lectures is to look at six particular issues. Today we'll begin, as Anthony mentioned, with the theme of nuclear weapons and proliferation. Is the nuclear genie definitively out of the bottle? And what does the proliferation of nuclear weapons mean for the possibility of war and peace in the 21st century? Next lecture, I'm going to look at climate change, which of course is now an increasingly fashionable topic, but an increasingly urgent one as well, and ask from a security point of view, how is climate change likely to play out in international relations, and what kind of new or old security challenges in a more reinforced way will climate change bring? Third lecture, I'm going to look at international terrorism. 8 years after 9/11, 2001, Is Al-Qaeda, is international terrorism still the massive threat that it seemed when the World Trade Center was attacked and the Pentagon was attacked 8 years ago? Fourth lecture, I want to look at energy security and ask in particular, are we going to a world of energy scarcity where nations will be increasingly competing with each other, perhaps in military forms, for ever scarcer energy resources? What are the threats to our critical energy infrastructure? Lecture number five, I'm going to look at failed states. There are a lot of them about. And therefore, is NATO likely to be engaged in the next 15 years in failed states in the same way that we've been engaged in the Balkans, in Afghanistan, over the last 15 years? Can you really do mission impossible and resurrect failed states and make them healthy? And finally, lecture number six, cyber attacks. What are the real dangers from a security point of view to hacking into computer systems? Is a cyber attack the equivalent of a military offensive when it comes to threatening the vital interests of a state? So that's, if you like, the menu which I'm offering you over the next few weeks. And as I say, I'd be very glad to see you back at future lectures. But now let's get on with the topic of today, nuclear weapons. For those of you, and I don't see many in this room, fortunately, of my generation, growing up under the sort of the shadow of the nuclear bomb has been a somewhat intimidating and sobering experience. The sword of Damocles of nuclear destruction has been with all of us, of course, since the nuclear weapon was first invented and first used 65 years ago at the end of the Second World War. Nuclear weapons, unlike previous weapons, made civilization reversible for the first time. Indeed, when I was slightly younger than most of you, there was a whole fashion of movies. You remember Dr. Strangelove with Peter Sellers, which I think is still as young today as it was in 1960 when it first came out, and a whole range of books which all sort of predicted, you know, what would be the consequences of living in a world where there had been a nuclear war. One of the first books that I read as a child was a book called On the Beach by Neville Shute, which described Australia with just a few people left alive, recovering from the aftermath of a nuclear war and trying to begin civilization once again from the Stone Age. There was therefore a great deal of worry at the question of, could we survive a nuclear war? And if so, how? What would, for example, the use of nuclear weapons create a nuclear winter, which would bring about a permanent ice age? In other words, if you weren't killed by the nuclear explosion, you'd be killed by the environmental impact that would come afterwards. And yet, the paradox, as I'm sure most of you are fully aware, is that on the one hand, there were these apprehensions and these fears and even a great deal of pessimism about the chances of escaping a nuclear war in one's lifetime. Nuclear weapons, after all, could not be disinvented, and they seemed destined to proliferate. But on the other hand, ladies and gentlemen, there was also the reality that we lived what the American historian John Lewis Gaddis called, at least in Europe, the Long Peace, a period in Europe where we had the longest period of peace since the days of Charlemagne. And nuclear weapons, paradoxically, received some of the credit for that, because there was the sense that the dangers of nuclear use were such that each side deterred itself as much as the other. It was mad, mutual assured destruction. The only purpose of a nuclear weapon was as a kind of guarantee that another person's nuclear weapon would not be used against you. And therefore, the worst weapon ever invented had a curious peacekeeping role in the sense of making war between the Soviet Union and the United States unthinkable. And indeed, despite all of the emphasis on proliferation and the mood of gloom and doom, we still are in a situation today where nuclear weapons have been used on only two occasions, and both, of course, at the end of the Second World War, 65 years ago, at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, of course, this attitude may be a bit too complacent. I realise that fully well. The first reason for the complacency is, of course, that the superpowers did come close, at least on one occasion, to an actual nuclear exchange. That was in October 1962, of course, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Second is that there have been, of course, from time to time, a series of shocks where a technical failure in an American radar system or a Russian radar system has happened during the 1990s, when the Russian leadership for a while mistook the launch of a Norwegian weather satellite as a possible US launch. It was rapidly cleared up, but there was a moment of hesitation. So a technical failure, even a flock of geese flying over the American NORAD air defense system in the 1970s could provoke a full-scale alert. And Henry Kissinger famously put the American nuclear forces on a DEFCON 1, a full-scale strategic alert, during the Yom Kippur War, the Arab-Israeli Yom Kippur War, in 1973. So there have been, if not nothing quite as close as the Cuban Missile Crisis, several moments of panic. And secondly, of course, it has to be said that although nuclear deterrence did, yes, keep the peace in Europe, it certainly didn't prevent lots of other wars going on outside Europe, in which the two superpowers fought each other by proxy. And it's calculated that up to 25 million people were actually killed in those very conventional but still very destructive wars. Yet, that said, of course, the major fear today is that everything was fine as long as the two superpowers alone had the monopoly of a nuclear weapon, more or less in equivalent capacities, and that those two superpowers had developed via a series of arms control agreements. You remember the SALT process in the 1970s, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, the START process in the 1990s, Strategic Arms Reduction Talks, various treaties, even an agreement in 1972 between Nixon and Brezhnev on the prevention of nuclear war. As long as the two superpowers had developed this kind of understanding, both had an interest in surviving, both believed in the victory of its ideology, and therefore had an interest in staying alive to see the victory of its ideology. So as long as it was basically the Soviet Union and the United States, everything was more or less okay. They knew how to handle the nuclear weapon. But of course, today the fear is that we now are on the verge of a new wave of proliferation in which several new kids on the block are in the process of acquiring a nuclear capability. And can we rely upon these new kids on the block to show the same degree of rationality, the same degree of self-restraint and caution, the same interest in their own survival as powers, not to use the nuclear weapon, and to consider that a nuclear weapon is simply an insurance policy against, as I said earlier, somebody else with a nuclear weapon using it against you. So, in a nutshell, where are we today? Well, I think we, again, face a paradox. On the one hand, yes, the number of nuclear states has expanded. But on the other hand, the number of nuclear warheads is less than 50% of what it was in 1982 when Jonathan Schell wrote his famous book, The Fate of the Earth, which was, at least for my generation, the major anti-nuclear tract of the day. Today we have about 23,000 nuclear warheads in existence in the world. Now, it's good that that is less than 50% of what we had in 1982. But the bad news is that that still represents 2.3 million Hiroshima's. So it's still enough to destroy the world several thousands of times over. That figure, therefore, is clearly still an excessive number. Where are we in particular? Well, the United States has 5,200 deployed nuclear warheads. Russia, about 4,138. France, about 350. The UK, about 160. China, anywhere between 100 and 200. Those are the five official nuclear powers, declared nuclear powers, that also happen to be, as all of you know, the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. Interestingly, of the new nuclear weapons in the world today, 95% are in the hands of the two countries, United States and Soviet Union. Or Russia, as it is now. A lapsus, but Russia today. That I'll come back to in a moment. Second is the new kids on the block, as I called them. India has about 100 warheads, according to calculations. Pakistan about 60. North Korea, anything from 6 to 12. Israel, which has never confirmed officially that it is a nuclear power, has an unspecified number. There are various guesstimates, but nobody, apart from the Israelis, of course, knows for certain. And South Africa did have a nuclear program, but gave it up in 1993. So in other words, although, yes, there have been several new entries into the world of nuclear weapons, there have been some successes of countries which have voluntarily agreed to terminate nuclear programs. I mentioned South Africa at the end of the apartheid period and thereafter. Other examples are Argentina and Brazil. Other countries have been operating programs in the past, but have decided to desist. So the prognostication of John Kennedy, President Kennedy, back in the 1960s, that by the end of his presidency, which should have been 1964, of course, tragically, he was assassinated before, as you know, his prediction that by 1964 there would be 25 nuclear states, has still not come true, even 40 years later. Indeed, in the 1960s, it was calculated that 23 countries, either had the nuclear weapon or had nuclear research programs, whereas today we have still just eight confirmed nuclear states. So the number of warheads has gone down, and the number and proliferation, at least in the past, has not been as bad as many predicted. That said, however, of course, today there are fears that that happy situation of relative consistency and stability is about to change. Why? I think the first reason is the fear of or worry that the impact of climate change, particularly the reduction in the use of fossil fuels like coal and oil, is going to lead to a rediscovery of nuclear. Already, my country, the United Kingdom, Finland, many others have decided to renew their nuclear programs. Others like Germany, which decided some time ago to abandon nuclear power, are rethinking. As nuclear power, particularly in an age of escalating or very volatile oil prices, becomes a more commercially viable option. The International Atomic Energy Agency has calculated that we may well go from about 300 civil nuclear power plants in the world today to as many as 1,400 by 2050. As world energy demand is predicted to soar by 45% over the next 20 years. Now, these are only predictions, but of course it does mean that if there are more and more countries which have civil nuclear power programs, potentially like Iran today, with the possibility of processing their own uranium fuel to feed their nuclear reactors, then it's going to be very, very difficult indeed to monitor so many countries and make sure that they are not secretly diverting the nuclear fuel or enriching it to produce weapons-grade material for nuclear weapons themselves. So how, therefore, do we take advantage of nuclear power from its environmental aspects, but without creating a world of massively proliferating military nuclear weapons states? First question. Second issue is what Mohamed El-Baradei, the outgoing head of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, has called the nuclear Walmart. This is, of course, the increasing fear that private sector companies or individuals can trade in nuclear materials, obviously for profit. You may recall the case of AQ Khan, the father of the Pakistani nuclear bomb, who was exposed a few years ago as having conducted a very lucrative private business in trading nuclear materials right across the world, selling these this information to countries like Libya, many others, and he was eventually, for a long time, placed under house arrest by the Pakistani authorities. He's the most notorious example, but there have certainly been many others, and therefore what good is it if states tighten up the rules on nuclear export controls if this private sector is left largely unregulated? Number three, the great worry about the future of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. Now, for much of my lifetime, the hope of safeguarding against nuclear proliferation has resided in the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which was concluded in 1968 and implemented in 1970. And today, virtually all of the countries in the world, with just three exceptions, Israel, India, Pakistan, participate in the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. But nobody would deny that this treaty has become increasingly vulnerable. The first reason is Article 6, which specified that the nuclear powers would agree to disarm and eventually give up their weapons in return for the non-nuclear powers agreeing not to acquire nuclear weapons and agreeing to safeguards, inspections, to make sure that they would not illicitly divert civilian nuclear programs to military use. So, of course, as we now go into the fourth decade of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, there are those who say, well, you know, the nuclear powers haven't kept their share of the bargain. They haven't disarmed, or they have a bit, but they not by much. They still rely upon nuclear weapons for their security, and therefore why should there be a sort of two-class tier in the international community? Those who are entitled to have the weapons because they say they need them for their security, and those who are denied them. So either the nuclear haves go down, or the nuclear have-nots will go up. And Mohamed El-Baradei himself, who participated in a conference on the strategic concept that we at NATO organised here in Brussels last July, said the following about this. He said, "We must abandon the unworkable notion that it is morally reprehensible for some countries to pursue weapons of mass destruction, yet morally acceptable for others to rely on them for their security and indeed to refine their capacities and postulate plans for their use." So we are stuck with this central conundrum of, you know, if the haves don't disarm, how can we persuade the others not to arm in the first place? You can live with that situation for a while, but not, of course, forever and ever and ever. The second problem, ladies and gentlemen, with the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty is that it allows legally, a country like Iran today to process its own fuel with its own reactors to at least a grade 3.5%, which allows you to run a civilian power station, on the assumption that you are not then going to jump the final step into a weapons program. But of course, if you can do 99% of the process legally, and then you only have to do the final 1% illegally, it's very difficult, of course, to prevent a country acquiring nuclear weapons. So how can we fix this problem, which preserves everybody's legitimate right to use nuclear power for peaceful civilian purposes, but avoiding this problem of everybody having their own enrichment plant and facility? Then, fourth reason why we may now experience more proliferation, regional rivalries. Jaswant Singh, the former Indian foreign minister, once said that the nuclear age entered India's neighbourhood when China became a nuclear power in October 1964. In other words, as soon as my neighbour had it, I needed to have it too, for reasons of prestige or reasons of security. But clearly, you know, countries don't only make these decisions alone in terms of their own programs, but very much in conjunction with what they perceive their neighbours as doing. And therefore, of course, the problem is that proliferation becomes self-replicating. He has it, I need to have it. He has it, then I need to have it. And so on and so on and so on. And of course, at the moment, as you know, those who of you who study this will see that, of course, in the wake of the Iranian activities, there's lots of speculation that other countries in the Gulf region will then need to react themselves by developing programs. So how can, again, you stop this kind of ongoing proliferation? Finally, of course, there is the fear of nuclear terrorism. The idea of the, as George W. Bush once put it, the worst weapons in the hands of the worst people. And in fact, President Obama, when he gave his speech in Prague earlier this year, when he called for the vision of a world without nuclear weapons, said, I quote, "In a strange turn of history, the threat of a global nuclear war has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up, precisely because there is this belief that individual terrorists would not show the same rationality as states when it comes to not using these capabilities." Now, it's not easy, ladies and gentlemen, frankly, to assess just how serious the prospect is of a terrorist getting access to a nuclear weapon. We do know from intelligence sources and revelations that Al-Qaeda has actively been pursuing nuclear technologies. And indeed, we are also been monitoring the diversion of nuclear materials from laboratories, particularly in the former Soviet Union. Indeed, it's reported that 1,300 incidents of nuclear materials being traded out of the former Soviet Union have taken place since 1993. Although it also has to be said, quite frankly, that sometimes these have been frauds. For example, there's this famous story of Osama bin Laden trying to buy a lot of uranium when he was living in the Sudan some years ago, and this turned out to be a product called red mercury, which so he lost his money very badly on that. It was a fraud, but so at least we know that terrorists are interested in this, even if, of course, that doesn't mean to say that they will either be able to get the material or master the technology. I mean, it's much easier, for example, to get one's hand on a biological or chemical product rather than a nuclear weapon, which does require a quite large superstructure. You can't hide it in your suitcase. Still, the fear is there. So, ladies and gentlemen, our group of experts, as it meets to look at the strategic concept, how worried should it be about this situation in terms of the security of the alliance? Well, some are quite relaxed about this situation. For example, there's a very well-known professor at the University of Chicago, John Mearsheimer, who has sort of said, well, you know, deterrence basically works, you know, if the nuclear weapon if the American nuclear weapon neutralized the Soviet nuclear weapon during the Cold War, then, you know, why can't the Indian nuclear weapon neutralize the Pakistani nuclear weapon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so a world of proliferation is not necessarily more dangerous. Nuclear weapons are such terrible weapons that anybody is going to think twice before using them, and they can, in fact, help to stabilize the situation. So that's one view. But of course, another view, which is one that I personally share, is that this would be accepting a terrible, terrible, terrible degree of risk, particularly if a country having nuclear weapons, which seems stable one minute, is then taken over by a group of radicals the next minute, who gain automatic access to the nuclear facilities. And ladies and gentlemen, just think back to 9/11. Think back to 9/11. Where then there was a terrorist attack on the United States that killed 3,000 people. That transformed international relations. We are still living in the shadow, in world security terms, of that attack. It defined the next decade and probably beyond. But it was not a nuclear attack. In fact, it was done by box cutters, you remember? Not even guns. Now, imagine a nuclear weapon being used by one state against another, no matter how remote, that would totally transform our lives and international relations, probably for a century, if not more. So although this may have a low probability, the catastrophic consequence is such that I personally believe that we should not live with a kind of complacent view that lots of mini deterrent systems will work, but should try to do what we can to reduce the importance of nuclear weapons in security perceptions and therefore the need to have them and acquire them as much as we possibly can. Now, how are we going to do this? Very briefly, because I want to obviously leave you time to ask me questions, and I hope you will have questions. Normally on this subject, you will have questions. I'm not sure if the answers will be as good, but we'll see about that in a moment. I think the first thing I think is that the major powers have got to renew their commitment, as President Obama has done, to a nuclear-free world. In other words, to confirm that we mean what we said in Article 6 of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty back in 1970, that it was our intention to work towards a world in which nuclear weapons would ultimately be abolished, even if you can't totally disinvent them. We know that this is not going to happen overnight, obviously. And we know that as long as states see threats, they are going to be reluctant to give up nuclear weapons if they believe that they enhance their security. That's obviously true. It will obviously be a step-by-step process. But to, again, posit it as a goal is a way of delegitimizing in the long run reliance upon nuclear weapons. So I think we should stick to that goal. And indeed, it's not just, if you like, left-wing people or in sort of radical NGOs who argue this, but indeed, back in 2007, four pillars of the American strategic community, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, George Shultz and Bill Perry, all former secretaries of state or secretaries of defense, or the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Sam Nunn, said precisely this in a very famous newspaper article, that they saw that we would ultimately be better off without nuclear weapons than with them, even if this is not something that can be achieved overnight. Second thing, the NPT, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, is going to be coming up next year. It's very important before the NPT starts to fracture that we reinforce it. How are we going to do this? Well, a commitment, of course, to arms control by the nuclear powers is certainly going to help, particularly a commitment that brings in China or others, because this has been essentially a Russian-United States bilateral affair for many years. But other ideas too, for example, making it illegal to withdraw from the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, as some countries like North Korea have done in the past. A question of making it impossible for countries to acquire nuclear technology if they have not agreed to the so-called additional protocol. In other words, the protocol of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, which means mandatory challenge inspections, a much more intrusive inspection regime than was in the original agreement, or the obligation to hand back nuclear technology to the supplier if you are found to be cheating. I mean, these are some of the ideas, ladies and gentlemen, in circulation of how you can reinforce the NPT. I think also that, as President Obama has made clear, the United States and Russia also have to set an example. I said earlier, they still have 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world today. And I therefore find it encouraging that Russia and the United States are now talking about post-START, or son of START. I don't think it has a name yet, but a new treaty. Because at the moment, the existing agreement between the US and Russia, which is START 1, which dates from 1991, is due to expire on the 5th of December this year. We don't, I believe, want to be in a situation where there is no ongoing agreement regulating the activities of these two very important countries. And the United States has proposed new ceilings, which would limit the number of warheads from 1,500 to 1,675, and the number of delivery vehicles being the technical jargon for missiles or for bombers, from 500 to 1,100. To have that in place before the NPT review conference next year would set a good example to the others of the willingness of the two major powers to actually go down. This is not going to be easy. Obviously not, because there are other factors that always come into play. You've seen that Russia in particular would like to have guarantees on American missile defense programs as a precondition for a new START agreement. I think personally, again, speaking personally, the United States also has an interest not only in limiting Russia's strategic weapons, but the very, very, very large number of tactical short-range systems that Russia has from the old days of the Soviet Union. But still, there is momentum there. Let's hope it is followed. I think another thing that we have to look at most urgently is to try to put a cap not just on nuclear weapons themselves, but on the missiles that deliver them. Because, frankly, ladies and gentlemen, a nuclear warhead is not much use to you if you don't have a missile to carry it 5,000 kilometres or whatever and deliver it to the target that you're seeking. And there has been a proliferation in a number of countries that have intermediate range ballistic missile capabilities. Every week you've seen North Korea, India, Iran, Pakistan, many countries test fire these intermediate range rocket systems. And yet, paradoxically, only Russia and the United States are held by any kind of international agreement limiting these systems. The INF Treaty that goes way, way back to the time of Ronald Reagan in the late 1980s. So we need to universalise this and also beef up other arrangements that exist, like the Missile Technology Control Regime, that put export controls on ballistic missile technology. Let me just mention a few final things that we can do. A test ban treaty. It exists. It exists. But there is a problem. The United States has yet to ratify it. And, of course, the US role, as always, in this area is going to be absolutely essential. And eight countries overall have to ratify it, particularly those countries which have nuclear weapons, before it can come into force. But this is important. The United States has carried out over 1,000 tests since 1945. Russia has carried out over 715 tests. Others too, Britain, France, many other countries have conducted tests. India, Pakistan in 1996-97, whole series of tests. And if you ban testing, you don't make it impossible to develop nuclear weapons. Computers can do a lot today, but you do make it much, much more difficult and much more costly. So we need to bring this treaty into effect as quickly as we can. We also need to ban the production of fissile material. We don't need any. We have today, ladies and gentlemen, in the world, 7,000 tons of surplus tons of uranium, fissile material. That is enough to build 300,000 nuclear warheads. So in other words, we can power the world's nuclear reactors for civilian fuel, electricity, more or less indefinitely, without ever needing to produce any more fissile material. Indeed, Mohammed El-Baradei, I mentioned him already, has come up with a plan, which to me makes a lot of sense, for a nuclear fuel bank. In other words, a kind of central petrol station run by the United Nations, where countries would get their fuel and would reprocess their spent fuel rods, all under international supervision. I mean, you know, you all have cars, but you don't have your own petrol stations, do you? You're quite happy to go to Texaco or BP or whatever. We fill up from a collective entity. And we should do the same here as well. And then finally, we can continue to do what we can in terms of international law to make it harder and harder and harder for states to trade in nuclear weapons materials. The UN Security Council Resolution 1540 of April 2004 goes in this direction of calling upon states to do more to safeguard their nuclear assets, to stop them being stolen or illicitly transferred, and to have more stringent export controls. So, in conclusion, the nuclear genie is certainly out of the bottle, yes. But that does not mean that we necessarily have to raise our arms in total surrender before the vista of an increasingly dangerous world of irrational nuclear proliferators. The major powers of the world have no interest in that scenario whatsoever. And if they do come together and act together, particularly with the review conference of the Proliferation Treaty next year, there is still time, to my view, to prevent that proliferation happening. Now, conclusion. What does that mean for the group of experts and the work of NATO and the strategic concept? Well, I think it means essentially three things. The first thing is, what can we do at NATO to build relationships with countries like India, China, Russia, with which we have a relationship already, Pakistan, and so on, to build a consensus around the view that we have to work together and send a clear common message to potential proliferators like Iran, to use those networks of partnerships. Secondly, what should NATO do to become more involved in the arms control debate, the whole debate about trying to establish new rules? I mean, we represent, after all, the United States, Canada, the major European countries. We are a large part of the voice. We are three members, permanent members of the UN Security Council. We've been rather quiet on these subjects, frankly, in the last few years as we've been involved in Afghanistan or the Balkans. But to my mind, though, this is just as important for our security. And we should try to develop common NATO positions at the United Nations in these negotiations. And the time is to do that is to start now. Conclusion number three is, of course, NATO still has nuclear weapons as part of its strategy. And I don't see that changing in the immediate future, particularly if there are some who will be worried that we're going towards a more dangerous, less predictable world, in which, therefore, a continuing existence of nuclear weapons in NATO strategy is a kind of hedge, a kind of guarantee against uncertainty. But as we go forward with a view to more arms control, more disarmament, one of the really critical questions for the group of experts and the strategic concept is, how in the alliance are we going to balance this continuing sense that our deterrence is composed of both nuclear assets, including dual-capable aircraft based in Europe, as well as reliance upon the American, British and French strategic systems, the nuclear weapons, conventional weapons as part of our strategy. How are we going to balance that against the idea of NATO also being prepared to make its contribution to the broader debate on disarmament and arms control, so that our policy is not, if you like, one set of rules for us and another set for others? This, I think, is going to be one of the central questions which we in the alliance will face in the future. And on that, I will thank you very much for your attention. Hope that I at least stimulated some questions. And now I'll do my best to answer. So who would like to start?
I was just wondering how you would see the US-India nuclear deal and its implications for the NPT review conferences.
Right. Well, this has been controversial, as you know, including in the United States itself, because on the one hand, it does make sense for the United States to engage an important country like India in some kind of bilateral negotiation on nuclear issues, undoubtedly, because, as I say, India is not a signatory of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. And therefore, absolutely, to have a sense where the US can assist India in developing its peaceful nuclear power by buying a modern American technology is useful, all the more so as India has the largest population in the world now, 1.3 billion. And like China, its energy is largely based on burning coal, which is a massive environmental polluter. So if you want to deal with global climate change, having India using less carbon and more alternative fuels like nuclear and putting less soot into the atmosphere every day is certainly a common global priority. So from that point of view, it makes a lot of sense. The other thing, of course, is that it means, too, that there can be some kind of international, at least, involvement in the Indian program. The real problem, of course, is that under this agreement, the Indian military nuclear programs are not concerned, and some people have sort of expressed anxiety that if, you know, India is getting civil nuclear help from the United States, it does not need to use any of its military nuclear fuel for civilian purposes, and therefore can obviously use that as part of its military program. The second thing is, it's obviously not easy when you're dealing with a country like Iran to say, you know, Iran, you must be part of the NPT arrangements and conform to these arrangements rigorously. If, you know, Iran sees, for example, that India is being given an arrangement which is outside the NPT. So my sense is that it depends on the long-term future. If this is a way of progressively bringing India into a multilateral conversation on the role of its nuclear programs in a way that ultimately, this would be my hope, could bring India into the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, even as a declared nuclear state, subject to the safeguards and inspections that will apply to all, this would be a good thing. So we'll obviously have to see how the future evolves in that respect.
Jamie, a few days ago, the media reported that the new German government intends to file a request that the United States would withdraw the nuclear weapons from German bases. How would that affect the symbolism implied in NATO solidarity? How will that affect the alliance?
Well, My sense on this, Alexander, is, first of all, this is a position which has been expressed in certain circles of the Free Democrats, which is now, as you know, the junior coalition partner in the German government, which was formed yesterday. It's not the position of the CSU, the majority party. And in any coalition, obviously, there is compromise, naturally. Looking at the government programme, it's not my impression that this is going to be put on the NATO agenda anytime in the immediate future, first thing. The second thing is that the United States itself is carrying out a so-called nuclear posture review, which means looking at all of, you know, America's nuclear weapons, requirements for nuclear weapons in the US as well as forward bases. And this is due to come out probably in January or February. I think that it makes sense in the alliance to wait for the Americans to have their nuclear posture review, because these weapons are all owned by the United States, as you know, even if some of them are carried in European aircraft, but they're American weapons. And then it's going to be easier to decide on a NATO policy. Thirdly, as I mentioned, the strategic concept exercise has to look from a NATO-wide perspective at these issues and decide, as I said at the end of my remarks, what is the appropriate balance between continuing to rely upon a minimal nuclear deterrent for one's security while contributing to an overall movement, an overall arms control dynamic, which is reducing still further the role of nuclear weapons in international security. So before, you know, anybody, if you like, fixes on a national position, I think it's probably going to be most helpful, A, to wait for the American Nuclear Posture Review, and secondly, to wait for the strategic concept to analyse this and come out with recommendations. It's obviously, as you said yourself, going to be much easier if we all move together as an alliance on this. I should add, though, that, you know, NATO has already carried out very substantial reductions. I mean, when I first joined the alliance so long ago that most of you weren't even born, maybe your mums and dads weren't even thinking of you being born either in those distant days. But when I joined the alliance in the 80s, we had 7,000 of these nuclear weapons in Europe. 7,000, I mean, a massive number. Today, the actual NATO figure is classified, so I can't give it to you, but it's in the couple of hundreds. So there has been this enormous reduction. And every NATO communique talks about, you know, having the lowest number, you know, the commensurate with our security, and further, you know, reducing as far as possible the nuclear part of the equation. So my sense is that the debate is not just about eliminating. The debate is also about, you know, just continuing where you can to reduce to the smallest number, which is commensurate with your security. And a lot of that's been done already. Yeah.
Why there is many talk about the program of Iran when at the same time there is an other state in the region like Israel that has nuclear weapons and so on and so on? Why there is many talk about eventually that Iran gets an maybe a nuclear weapon when there is not so much talk within the NATO about the nuclear weapons of Israel?
Good. Thank you very much for that. Well, I think the worry about Iran is twofold. First of all, we cannot deny this, but there has been a lot of rather bellicose rhetoric from the Iranian leadership, particularly vis-a-vis Israel, as you know. Of course, when you have a country which could be acquiring nuclear weapons, but indulging in very hostile rhetoric against its neighbours and other countries, that creates an unsettling situation. Let's be frank. I mean, people always ally nuclear weapons to the character of governments and regimes. That's clear. And that therefore, certain regimes create more anxieties than others. Secondly, Iran has a pattern of behaviour which contradicts its official statements. You know, the Iranians say that they are not seeking to acquire nuclear weapons. But then many of their actions in terms of the programmes they run, their reprocessing, a habit of secrecy, for example, are totally consistent with trying to acquire nuclear weapons. For example, Iran is a country which has vast amounts of oil and natural gas, but still has this focus on developing nuclear capabilities. Well, that's fine. That's perfectly legitimate because, in fact, the Iranians say, well, if they have nuclear power, they can sell their oil and natural gas abroad and earn money for it. So that's perfectly legitimate. But then why, if it's only developing nuclear power for peaceful purposes, does it refuse offers from Russia, offers from the other countries to give it a guaranteed supply of nuclear fuel? Why continue to insist on having your own, not you, but I mean, Iranian point of view, Iran's own processing facilities? Why insist on being able to enrich fuel to degrees higher than 3.5%? For example, the latest issue is that Iran is now trying to acquire fuel enriched to above 20%, ostensibly for medical purposes. So what I'm saying is that, you know, if Iran would be a little bit more transparent, you know, we've now recently discovered a secret new processing facility at Qom, which was inspected a couple of days ago by the International Atomic Energy Agency. If there was more a sense of trust and transparency, I think it would be easier to deal with. But as long as there's this contradiction between declared so-called peaceful intentions when it comes to civilian power, but an actual practice of acquiring technologies and so on, which are perfectly consistent with nuclear weapons, you know, I think the West is going to be, not just the West, but other countries will be on their guard. And you've got to remember, China and Russia, which are participating in these negotiations, in the past have also backed sanctions against Iran for a lack of total cooperation with the United Nations on this.
But why not on Israel? Israel is hostile to also to his neighbors like Lebanon, like Syria. They also don't have a transparency policy towards the NPT treaty or to other international organizations. Even Mohammed al-Baradei has visited Israel and he had talked with Sharon about eventually to inspect the nuclear facilities. But I never hear in the Western media and Western policymakers to have the same policy on Israel. Why do the Western policymakers don't have that same policy on Israel? To be harsh, to look in the nuclear facilities and to, yeah, and so on.
No, I take your point to the extent that it's true. As I said a moment ago, one of the issues here is the avoidance of a sense of double standards. And I referred to this quite a lot in my remarks. You know. Now, Israel is not part of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. You're correct. And Israel has kept a practice of great secrecy about its nuclear programs. Indeed, there was a very interesting moment when the former Prime Minister, Ehud Olmert declared in Berlin a year ago, shortly before he stepped down, that Israel did have a nuclear capability. And this created a scandal in Israel because it was the first time that a prime minister had broken away from the policy of neither confirming nor denying on this particular issue. But it's generally assumed, yes, that Israel does have nuclear capabilities. And it is the case that many other countries justify, for example, programs in chemical weapons or biological weapons, which they call the poor man's nuclear bomb, by the need to have some kind of capacity vis-a-vis Israel. And my sense is that, yes, what we should be doing is ultimately bringing all countries, including India and Pakistan, I said this a moment ago, North Korea too, back into a universal nuclear proliferation regime in which everybody would be respecting the same rules. But if we have a situation where we tolerate the ongoing addition of new nuclear powers to the eight that we already have, this is going to become infinitely harder. So irrespective of the merits of Israel or any other state, to my mind, we have to at least sort of stabilise the situation around the idea that we are not going to, to the extent we can, we are not going to tolerate the emergence of new nuclear powers. Let's consolidate where we are, then bring everybody into the same rules-based system, and then go down. But you can't, on the one hand, be tolerating more nuclear powers entering the scene while you're trying, as I said, to put the genie back into the bottle and go down. And again, a lot is to do with the character of states. Israel doesn't go around threatening to destroy other states and remove and wipe them out and remove them from the map. And as I said, you tend to link these weapons inevitably to the character of certain regimes, certain governments, and some cause more anxiety than others. It's simply a fact of life. Well, clearly your generation hasn't worried about these issues as much as my generation did. Maybe not. So,
on Pakistan, what's NATO's assessment in terms of the probability or dangerous possibility of terrorist networks acquiring nuclear weapon capacities. Is there a kind of NATO view on this and assessment, and what could be done about it?
One fear has always been that that nuclear states would become destabilized. We already had, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, you remember, particularly in the Bush administration, the administration of George H.W. Bush at the time, a great deal of anxiety about loose nukes, what would happen, particularly as Ukraine overnight, because of the collapse of the Soviet Union, became the world's third biggest nuclear power for a while. And then, there was a lot of really a hard American diplomacy to persuade Ukraine to give those weapons back to Russia in exchange for American economic assistance. So that was a massive proliferation problem, which was thankfully avoided. But I use it as an example to show that, yes, there is always anxiety about, what would happen if a nuclear state collapses into chaos, or a much different, much more hostile radical regime would take over. Now, when it comes to Pakistan, I don't have details, because they're very, very secretly guarded about the safety measures surrounding the Pakistani nuclear weapons. What the little I do know suggests to me that the Pakistani military is very aware of this and has those weapons under very tight guard and command and control. That said, 2 weeks ago, there was an attack against the Pakistani main army base at Rawalpindi, which you saw, which for a while successfully penetrated that extremely guarded base and took over one of the buildings. All right, it was eventually dealt with, but it does show that terrorists can get inside Pakistani army bases. But still, my sense is that these weapons are closely guarded. So I the scenario I think that would concern us is not that terrorists would smash their way into an army base and steal a nuclear weapon. No, it's obviously more complicated than that. The real danger would be that a different form of government would take over, which was a very radicalised, very hostile government, which then obviously would have control of those nuclear weapons. What is our policy there? To make sure it doesn't happen. Obviously, by supporting the present civilian government of President Zardari as much as possible. And you see the United States, for example, moving in this direction already by creating a new aid budget of $7.5 billion, over the next 5 years for Pakistan, so that Pakistan can invest in schools, in development, in its economy, and so on, to preserve a stability. It's no good just fighting the radicals, no matter how welcome in Waziristan or the Swat Valley, if you don't have another program, of course, which is to develop the Pakistani economy. That said, I'm quite sure, without knowing the details, that the United States has a dialogue with the Pakistani authorities on these issues, and the US has got a lot of experience in the safety of nuclear weapons, particularly things called PALs, permissive action locks, which are certain keys and codes that make it impossible to use a nuclear weapon unless you are part of state authority. And, for example, the United States over the years has invested very heavily in Russia, in the former Soviet Union, in safeguarding nuclear sites, working on security and so on. So there is a program. For example, you may recall Senator Dick Lugar, Senator Nunn, who developed something called the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program in the former Soviet Union to help, particularly Russia, improve the safety of its systems. And I'm sure that something similar could easily be developed for Pakistan as well.
You shortly mentioned a fissile material test of ban treaty. Do you think there's
a cutoff? Yes, yeah, called the cutoff treaty.
Yes,
sounds painful, doesn't it?
A bit, yeah.
Cutting something off, but that's what it's called. Yeah.
Do you think there's any chance that there will be one very soon, or on the short term, or not?
Well, that's a good question. I think that the Obama administration certainly wants to revitalise these treaties. As you know, one of the problems frankly, that we had in the last 10 or 15 years was the sense that, you know, the country with the largest stocks of nuclear weapons, the United States, was not the one which was setting the example. You remember the United States did not ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, for example, at the time. You know, the problem in Washington was that the Congress wanted to see a 100% perfect treaty. But you know, if you, in life, will only ever accept the 100% perfect solution to anything, you know, the 100% perfect wife, or the 100% perfect husband, or the 100% perfect job, you know, or the 100% perfect children, you'll never get them. You'll be waiting a long time. And therefore, to use a phrase, the perfect became the enemy of the good. And I think this sort of sense that the United States was not committed also had a spillover effect into areas like the cutoff treaty, or another thing which I didn't have time to mention today, the verification regime for the Biological Weapons Convention, which still lacks a verification, a proper verification regime. Now, the Obama administration has promised to reverse all this, and so that, I think, is going to obviously increase the prospects. But the issue will be the following. And this has already happened with Iran. You know, the Iranians, come back to your question, sir, from a moment ago, say, look, you know, you tell us not to process our own nuclear fuel. You tell us to rely upon a fuel bank. But how can we be guaranteed that we will have that access to the fuel bank? That you're not going to suddenly say, aha, gotcha, we're cutting it off. Because you haven't behaved, or you've done something that we don't like, or whatever. For example, the Iranians were in a consortium called Eurodif, where they had a 10% share, but they were cut out of it. And so they say, look, you know, you guys broke your promises to us in the past, so how can we trust you? And therefore, we process our own fuel, because that's the only guarantee we have. If we don't, so we're going to have to sort of come up, I think, with an international treaty that does guarantee countries access to fuel, irrespective, if you like, of their foreign policies. Because if there's a sense that, you know, you make a hostile statement and the next day, bang, you're cut off. You know, countries will want to have their own processing, and the cut-off treaty will become an impossibility. So we're going to have to think sort of, you know, very hard about this idea of guaranteed access and de-link it from, you know, the fact that we don't like a particular country or day-to-day politics. Right. Well, in that case, I'd like to thank you all very much again for being here today and being such a good audience. And as I said, the next one will be on climate change. And I hope you will be here on that occasion as well. Look forward to seeing you again. So thank you very much.